So I think we have most of the audience today. I've done this several times. I just want to get an idea. How many of you have attempted the 461 exam and are here to kind of fill in the blanks? We had a few, right? So most of you, this is Greenfield. How many of you have never taken a certification exam? Oh, okay, good. So the lead-in slides will give you a lot of good information. So I'll introduce myself. I'm Bob Taylor. I work in Premier Developer at Microsoft, so I consult with ISVs and enterprise customers to help them with SQL Server. I do .NET as well. I'm old. I've been around a long time, done a lot of things. I started with Fortran on punch cards in 72. Worked on a magnetic drum-based computer doing assembly language program, courtesy of the United States government, the Marines. I started with SQL Server in the first version after it came off of OS 2 Presentation Manager, the Sybase version. I've been certified on every version. I'm one of the few people that actually passed 70-19, the data warehousing on SQL Server 7.0 exam. So I've been involved in the certification process since 93. I've written exams. Before I was a Microsoft employee, I wrote both the SQL 2000, two of the 2005, and the MCSD .NET, I wrote all of those. So broad developer experience, and hopefully it'll be useful to y'all. All right, here's what we're going to cover today. Ooh, that's a big screen. How do you become certified? So these are the basic slides that MSL wants us to deliver. So we have a lot of folks that this is your first time, so this will be very good information. We're going to talk about how do you identify what your goal is. Why do you want to do this? What do you want to get out of it? Which certifications are important to you? Then we're going to go through the steps. We're going to figure out how do you identify the gaps in your knowledge based on the learning objectives for the exam. And then we'll go through and we'll cover a lot of the different items that you're going to be expected to see on the exam. Okay? I'm not going to teach you the exam, but I'll show you a lot of the information that you can expect to see on the exam. All right, Microsoft certification. For you, it's to help you increase your knowledge, to show your boss that you're smarter than your peers. For me, the value of certification is being exposed to the breadth of the product. Normally, in our day-to-day work, we're focused on a silo portion of the product. By doing the certification, it forces you to study areas that you may not use on a day-to-day basis, so it gives you a broader perspective on the whole product. And then a lot of folks, once they've gone through the process and they're comfortable with the material, they'll turn around and retrain their coworkers, which again is something that the hiring managers and all like, that you're able to do that. Again, I'm not going to read these for you. You can do it at Tech Ed. Unfortunately, that's cutting out. Is that okay in the back? It keeps cutting in and out for me. They put us on the last day, so you really have to rush to go take your exams today. But we'll give you a lot of the information. Two things I recommend. It's not on the slides, but go up to the study hall. We have the practice exams up there, the Transcender practice exams. They're usually about $200 to purchase. They're free today. Also, Safari Books Online. If you log in and register today in the study hall, you'll get 30 days access after Tech Ed is over, and that includes all the MS Press training kits. And somebody was saying for the 461, 462, you're actually able to download the PDF of the books and keep them after that 30 days is up. So great resources. All right. In the past, and I can speak from those days, we had a thing called the paper MCSE. We actually had a 12-year-old in Indonesia get his MCSE. And basically, there were brain dumps and all this other stuff that was out there on the internet. And the rigor wasn't there to protect the value of your certification. So the new versions of the certification, it's called Cert V2, we're trying to increase the rigor of the exams so that when a hiring manager sees that you have your MCSE data platform, that tells them a certain thing about you and makes it more relevant. The relevance is we're trying to keep it up to date and current, and that's why in the new version of the certification program, once you've achieved your MCSE, you're required to recertify periodically. So you're certified originally through the MCSA on a version like SQL 2012. Then you get your MCSE, which is version non-specific. Then you're required to take the MCSA exams, the recertification exams for 2014 or 2016, whatever the next version is. And generally right now it's about a 3-year period, and it depends on when they have budget to create the recertification exam, so it could be longer than 3 years. That's really the big drawback. Again, we talked about the broader skill set, being exposed to everything, but we also try to take you deeper into the skill set. In the past, there were a lot of multiple choice exams, questions. Okay, so these are all the upper level certs. Boom, boom, boom. You can see MCSE, business intelligence and data platform, share the common MCSA. So MCS, and I have slides on this in just a second, so I'm not gonna spend a lot of time. Let's go on. I wanna get to the meat, but I have to do these slides, so. We're trying to do more real world exam questions. So rather than just saying, blah, 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 A, B, C, D, choose one, and it's a memorization type exercise, we're trying to give you tasks that you might have to do as a DBA. What are the steps to restore a database? So rather than just having a multiple choice, we have these new item types. For example, drag and build a list. So you'll have a list of 10 steps that could be possible. You have to choose the correct steps and put them in the correct order. So it really says, yes, I know I have to restore the full backup, the differential, the transaction logs, and then do recovery, and I do them in this order. So it's really testing more the fact that you've done it before, because just trying to memorize all that stuff and just go in and come up with the build list, if you haven't actually accomplished that task in the real world, it's probably going to be a little more difficult. So we're trying to make it more relevant. There are some new item types as well. It didn't test out well in the initial version of the 461 exam, but they're still working on it, where you actually had to write Transact SQL code. And there was a parser, and it would parse it, and you had to actually, you know, it would say, find all the customers that have more than 3 orders from, you know, and that live in California. And you'd actually have to write the Transact SQL to do that, which I think is awesome. But again, they had some problems. A simple example like that, I wrote some of the early ones, had 83 distinct sets of answers. So trying to come up with all the correct ways, ANSI, non-ANSI, is there a semicolon at the end? You know, you had to come into all those patterns. So it's making it difficult, yes. Okay, they may still be in there. Let's just say that sometimes not all of the items in an exam actually count towards your score. I'll just leave it at that. A lot of times when they're trying new item types, they'll seed the exam with the new item types, but they don't necessarily count toward your score. They just want to see how people perform on them. All right. Most of the exams are between 40 to 60 questions. The time period varies. If you have case studies, then you generally get more time. A case study being where we have this UI and there's about 8 different categories on the left, like business requirements, security, technical requirements, user interaction, and then there's each of those tabs have a bunch of business requirements. Then you're given a set of about 10 questions that refer to the business requirements. So now it's not just it's at what they call the synthesis level in Bloom's taxonomy, where you actually have to take the knowledge and put it together to come up with an answer. So the case studies are generally a little higher level, and they can be difficult at times, especially if it becomes a reading comprehension issue. But you'll find the case studies will give you more of that kind of information. If you have a case study, there's a limitation on the testing center end. When you complete a case study, you cannot go back to it. So that's important to note. If you get an exam that have case studies, when you say, I'm done with this case study, there's no going back. unlike the other exams where you can freely float, you know, back and forth, mark them for review, and come back to them. 700 is the passing score, but 700 does not mean 70%, okay? 700 is a magical number. When the exam is first sent out in beta, we invite people that were certified on the previous version to take it, so people that we know are qualified. And then we look to see how all the items perform. We then say the minimally qualified candidate should know this, 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 and this, and that comes out to be 54 out of 70 questions. And that 54 becomes that 700 that you get on your score sheet. So just know that 700 doesn't mean 70%. On some exams, the SQL 2000 admin exam, it was actually about 54% equated to the 700. So that generally means that the exam's not that great, but we've come a long way since then. Just talk that. Right, the last one is the key. There are no points deducted for wrong answers like in the SAT. So if you get down and you say, I know it's not that, it's a 50-50 choice, rather than leaving it blank, go with your gut and choose one of the two that you think it could be. The goal for a well-written question, you should be able to read the top part of the question, what we call the stem, the description of what it is you're trying to do, and the goal statement. And if you're qualified on that topic, you should already know in your mind before you look at the answers what answer you're looking for, and you should be able to find it in the list. So a well-written exam question telegraphs the answer to the qualified candidate. So all the questions have this consistent anatomy, and we'll be done with this MSL slides in just a second, and we get on to the good stuff. They start with a problem statement. So you are a DBA at Contoso, and you need to create a stored procedure that will, boom. And then you have the goal statement. What should you do? Which should you choose? What is the best? Best is hard. We don't like those. Which tool should you use? So it's a very clear what should you, and that's the goal. So when you first look at the question, a lot of times, if you're comfortable with the material, you can look at the goal statement, look at the answers, and then if you need to, go back and read the paragraph up top. So the paragraph up top can be lengthy at times. It can be several paragraphs because there's a lot of information that they have to give you to say that the right answer is right, and they have to give you enough information in the paragraph to say the wrong answers are wrong. Okay? So that's just something you have to be aware of. There are different item types. In some cases, it's a multiple choice, one of four, one of five. That will be a radio button. We also have choose two. It'll say blah, 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 choose two items. Or they'll say choose all that apply. Those are check boxes. The choose all that apply sometimes can be difficult because we prefer not to do exam items with choose all that apply because it really doesn't tell us anything more about the candidate, whether they're qualified or not. Item writers are trying to make their items harder by making it choose all that apply. Now, in some cases, if it's important to know that and it's the only way to test it, then, of course, that we have to do it. So in each case, we have the correct answer, which always has to be 100% correct, and then we have the distractors, which have to be wrong. In current versions of the exams, they have to be possible. So if it's Transact SQL code, it should run, it should do something, just not accomplish your goal. In the past, like in the 2000 exams, there were no constraints. We could say, if I wanted to do this, what do I do? And we could create SP_Bob's cool procedure. and that could be a distractor. It didn't have to exist in the product. Now everything you see has to exist in the product, has to function, just doesn't accomplish the goal. And this is debatable, some people still fight this, but our goal is not to trick you. We want the people that are qualified to pass the exam. What we don't want is the people that are not qualified to not pass the exam. It's that clear cut. And we have this concept of a minimally qualified candidate. So if I'm a hiring manager, I would like to know that if you have this certification, you can do at least X. And that's what we use when we're trying to decide that cut score. So your goals. This is the MCSA 2012 path. It consists of three exams, the 461, 62, and 63. You're here for 461, we'll be doing 462 this afternoon. 463, we don't have a prep session for, unfortunately. When you get the three of those, you get the MCSA SQL Server 2012. Right now we're reseeding these exams with 2014 questions, okay? So they don't have an MCSA SQL Server 2014, and they don't have plans for it. It'll probably be, sorry, I'm gonna move this, because it seems like I keep, maybe not to you, but to me when I'm hearing the feedback. Okay, so, is that okay? Okay, there we go. All right, so the SQL Server, I can talk loud enough. I was in the Marines for 18 years, so I don't necessarily have to use the mic. I don't know if they're recording this. So you can get the MCSA 2012. Then you can layer on the two additional exams, 64 and 65, which are more deep dive into the programming side and the administration side of SQL Server. So things in 464 you would see is things like service broker. Endpoints, some of the other programming that you wouldn't get at the MCSA level. And then you would get your MCSA data platform. There's also 466 and 467, which would then give you the MCSE business intelligence. So the underlying structure for both the MCSE data platform and business intelligence are 461, 62, and 63. Then you take two more exams to get the MCSE that's specific to what you're trying to accomplish. All right. This doesn't help you right now, but that's a hyperlink. But these slide decks will be available for you to download after the session. It may not be right after the session. It might be, you know, sometime in the near future on the TechEd site. But that's the MS Learning exam prep guide. That's what we recommend everyone does. Go there first. There's a detailed breakdown, and that's what we're going to use to drive the discussion today. But it gives you all the major functional groups, so create objects, query data. And then under that, it has bullet items that list the learning objectives that will be tested on the exam. It also gives you the percentage of the exam that's going to be spent on objects and querying and so on and so forth. So it gives you a really good idea of where you're, you know, first of all, it's a laundry list of things you can say, yes, I do that, yes, I do that, ooh, I haven't seen that, I better study that, and so on. So that gives you that kind of the roadmap to take. All right. So here's what we're going to talk about today. In the 461, it's pretty evenly weighted amongst all the options. We have the... Yeah, it's when I turn my head. So I'm going to be facing the screen, so I'm going to put it there, and I think we get it covered. If not, I'll just talk loud. So create database objects, working with data, modify data, and troubleshoot and optimize queries. So these are the broad areas. Again, this hyperlink will take you to the details. Also on those detail pages, there's preparation information. So are there self-study guides available? Are there training videos available, like on Microsoft Virtual Academy? How many people have been to Microsoft Virtual Academy? Excellent. There's some great training videos up there. Also, instructor-led training, our Microsoft official curriculum are there. And then anything like the training kits will also be listed there. So highly recommend we go. So let's get down to the real. So we're going to talk about creating database objects. This is the first objective. Be sure that you know the new data types. They're not new to SQL 2012. They were introduced actually in 2005, but it's important because you're going to be tested on them. So these are all, the XML and spatial are user-defined data types. They're system user-defined data types, which means in addition to being a data type, there are methods that you can call. So think of a C-sharp class that has methods. These items, XML, the geometry and geography, can be, that DLL can be included in a .NET project, and you can use them just like regular .NET classes. But in SQL Server, you can also use them. You can have an XML column and say dot .exists and actually call functions on your data in SQL Server. So that's something that's a little different. Most people haven't dealt with that. And it's important that you're comfortable with that because you will see questions on nodes, exists, query using XPath. Additionally, we introduced the spatial data types. We have geography and geometry. Kind of you can figure that out. Geography is the curved earth coordinates. Geometry is the flat planar coordinates. So, you know, obviously they're 2D. We don't support 3D like some other RDBMS vendors do. So hopefully that'll come in the future. In 2008 R2, we introduced the date and time discrete data types. In the past, we always had to use date time, which carried along a time component even if you didn't want it. So now you can say this is just a date, and all the storage costs that you'll incur is just for the date, and there's no more chopping all the zeros off and doing all those manipulations. So be comfortable with the date. The time is just what it sounds like. Time, you can specify the precision of the seconds after the decimal point. So you can say time, comma, 3. You only want to keep the seconds to 3 decimal places. So it gives you some ability to manage the storage requirements for your data type and store just what you need to store. Date time 2 is very similar to the old date time. It was cleverly named. And what they do is this gives you the multi-precision as well on the seconds. So on a date time, you can say I want up to 7 digits of precision. So after the decimal point on the seconds, I can go down to 7. So for those of you that have worked with date time in the past, it was a 3 millisecond resolution. Resolution. 3 milliseconds was kind of the, and you had to deal with that around midnight and all those kinds of fun things. Now it's down to a microsecond. So up to 7 digits of precision. If you have questions as we're going along, I get excited and get moving. Don't hesitate. We'll try to keep everything and get through all the slides, but if you have specific questions, go ahead and raise your hands as we're going through. Okay. Datetime offset gives you the ability to put time zone offsets onto dates. So you can say, if I have UTC, Greenwich Mean Time, and I'm on the East Coast, you can now carry along the +4. Now, it does not take daylight savings time into account. That's still a problem that nobody's really solved, because daylight savings times, as we know just here in the US, the rules change, and you almost have to have a whole database of ranges of dates to decide whether a date was in daylight savings time at any given point in time in history. So it doesn't do that, but it will carry the +4, the -3, and so on and so forth. So if you want to carry date time, time zone offsets, that's what the date time offset does. You will see questions on constraints. Constraints are just what they sound like. We're constraining the data in our database. They consist of multiple types. We have check constraints, default constraints, primary key, foreign key constraints, and unique constraints. They will fall in this format. When you're defining a table, you'll have a column definition like customer ID, a constraint name like primary key, and then the type, which is primary key, and then the options. So whether it's a unique, whether it's clustered for a primary key. Things to note, if a primary key is declared for a table and you do not explicitly state that it's non-clustered and there is no clustered index on that table, SQL Server will assume you wanted a clustered index, whether that's good for you or not. If you want to get into index discussions, the primary key isn't always the best clustered index for your table, but that's way beyond the scope of this. A foreign key allows you to have referential integrity between tables. So if you were doing ER modeling, you would have customer places orders. The way you enforce the places is you create a foreign key constraint from the orders table to the customer table. And the syntax is very similar, foreign key. In this case, the options would have references, and it would reference a column in another table. And what this does is when you insert data into the table, it checks to make sure that value actually exists in the table that it's referencing. So it's a way to make sure that you're not putting in data that cannot be joined later on. You're not orphaning data, you're not putting in bogus data. Unique constraint is something that if you have data that you know is unique in a column, be sure and put the unique constraint on it. The reason is that the query optimizer uses that information and it says, oh, they're asking for something in this column, there's a unique constraint, I know there can only be one row, and it makes a better choice when it's doing the query execution plan. A default constraint allows you to be lazy. No, a default constraint allows you to provide a value if the user does not provide a value. A common one is added date, you know, somewhere you're tracking the date that the row is added. You might set a default constraint set to get date. So it would take the current date and time at the time, at the point in time that that record was entered, and will automatically provide it for you. You don't have to provide that when you're inserting the data into your table. So any questions on constraints? Okay. DML triggers, there's two types of triggers, DML and DDL. DML is data manipulation language. That's for when you're doing insert, update, selects, those kinds of things. DDL is when you're creating objects. So we're not, you don't really have to worry too much about the DDL triggers. Because they don't test on them. So DML triggers are triggers that fire after a transaction has fired. So I insert a row of data into a table, and maybe check constraints or foreign key constraints are not robust enough to do the processing that I need to do. So what happens is we have two types of triggers. We have an instead of trigger, which fires instead of the data being placed into the table. The trigger gets called and you can do additional processing. Maybe you have to look up values from other tables. The after is exactly what it sounds like. After the row's been inserted, you're presented with the before and after image of the row. So there are two pseudo tables, the inserted and the deleted table. They don't exist anywhere except in memory and in the context and the scope of a trigger. So you may see here, let's see, does it have one of these cool things? Yeah, it does. So here are the pseudo table inserted. So you can actually capture, you know, these are the row that was being inserted. In this case, it is an insert. It could be also an update. So at that point, you can do additional information or additional processing. The key triggers operate in the context of the surrounding transaction. So if we're in a high volume OLTP system doing lots of transactions, having triggers can slow that down because we have to accomplish the processing in the trigger before we can actually commit that transaction and harden it to the transaction log. Yes, sir? No, so it's a good question. There's always inserted and deleted. So if it's an insert, the deleted has no rows. If it's an update, both the inserted and the deleted have values. And if it's a delete, only the deleted has values. Yes, so it's a combination. And that's why you can do after insert, comma, update. Yes, sir? Yeah, instead of we'll present the same, the inserted and updated, yes. Inserted and deleted. There are other functions that are not going to be tested on the exam, but you can actually find out which columns were updated or in an update, for example. So there's a lot of processing there. If, in fact, you are on a system, this is real world, just gift to you, there is, since SQL 2012, there is a DMV called sys.dmv_triggerstats. And if you think you're spending a lot of extra time in triggers, you can go in there and see how much time is being spent. It's like the query exec stats that you would use for regular queries. Yes?
So the
basic, yes. Not the advanced stuff, yeah. Yeah, it's going to ask you to, it may show you a trigger code and it, you know, ask you what is it doing, or it may say you need to be able to, you have a view, which we're chicken and egg, sorry, on the slides, but a view. If you have a view and you want to update the underlying tables, oftentimes you'll use the instead of trigger, because with a view, you can only update a single table that's part of the view directly. So you'll use an instead of trigger, and that, so it's kind of that. It may give you a scenario, you know, you have a view with three tables and you need to update columns in all three tables. What should you do? Create instead of trigger on the view. Okay. Good, good, good. So views, just happened to mention them. There are certain restrictions. Again, these are things that, unfortunately, it's just these are things you need to know. In the real world, Books Online is a fabulous reference. If you haven't used it, definitely load it up. It's the online documentation. There's an online version on TechNet, but there's also an on-prem, on, you know, your local machine copy that you can download. So it's Books Online, and it's the, is, I don't keep a lot of this stuff in my head. You go there and you look for it. So for a view, the view cannot contain more than 1,024 columns. Thankfully. But anyway, it has to be a single query or a single query expression. So you can have union statements with multiple selects, but the goal is it's a single result set that comes out of it, a single unified result set. So that is a restriction for views. You can't, like in a stored procedure, you can execute multiple queries that return multiple result sets and then iterate through them on the client code. A view is a single result set. There are some restrictions on data modifications. Like I said, if you are updating multiple columns on multiple tables that participate in the view, you have to use an instead of trigger and manually do those updates. If you're only updating a single table of the many tables in the view, you can do that directly. If you're doing, in your view, you want to say, I want to get the top 2% or the top 25 items, you have to provide an order by clause in the view. So that's just something syntactically that you have to remember. If there's a top, there needs to be an order by. Because top operates on the sorted output of the order by to give you the top X number that you're going to be returning. There's some options. There's a typo there. Schema binding says that when I create this view, I do not want to allow anybody to modify any of the underlying objects that participate in the view. Okay, so if you have a view created and it has with schema binding, you cannot alter a table that participates in the view without dropping the view first. And it's good practice, and it's designed to keep the view consistent and not have the view be out of sync with the tables that participate in the view. It's also required if you're doing something that's known as an indexed view. An indexed view actually materializes the results of the view to disk as a, essentially as a table, and it can be a really good performance improvement. With encryption just means the text. When you look at it, if you were to look at it in sys comments, it would be, you couldn't read it. It's encrypted. And this really applies more to like ISVs that are, you know, delivering their code to customers and they don't want their customers to see the IP and see what the transact SQL is that they're using. This is also available on stored procedures, for example. So you can encrypt it. just be careful. Don't do it just because it'd be a fun thing to do. Because the altar tables and some of the other stuff, it gets a little tricky when you're using the encryption. The typo view, there should be an underscore between view and metadata. And what that says, for certain clients, like ODBC, DB Library, I think it's ADO.net, a lot of times that connection will ask SQL Server, hey, if I select from that view, can you tell me what I'm going to get back? And then it builds an area in memory for the result set. If you use with view metadata, we will only report the name of the view and the columns in the view. If you do not have the view metadata option on your view, it will return all the tables and all the columns. So for performance reasons, if you're using one of those clients, having the view metadata on there is much more efficient, because we don't have to build this huge buffer on the client side and where we're not using 90% of it. So, check just says, as people insert data into the view, I want to be sure that it doesn't cause a row to fall out of the view. So if I were to change, state, and the view was only on California, Washington, and Oregon, and I were to change the state to New Jersey, and I had with check on, it would not allow that update, because it would then take a row that was in the result set from the view and cause it to fall out of the view. Again, these are going to be more of the multiple choice questions. Just know what each of these options do and be able to identify them from a list based on the requirements in the STEM. Questions? No? Yes? No. You have to drop the view, alter the table, and then recreate the view. And it's designed to keep the view consistent with the tables.
Even though the column is not part of the view?
You cannot. Yeah. It's a schema lock that we won't allow you to do that. Okay? So, you're a database developer. So this is kind of the format that you'll see. You are a database developer. One of the requirements, you want to do searchable maps of a warehouse. What data type should you use? So that's kind of the pattern. There's the business requirements, then there's the goal statement. And the goal statement is, which data type should you use? Anybody? Perfect. The idea here being that the geometry is the flat surface. Again, there's no Z, but you can do that in other ways. So again, this is just kind of the type of question you might see. So that's kind of the database objects, querying the data. There's some new functions that were added in SQL 2012 in addition to some of the other functions that already existed. If you look up Nilatic functions in Books Online, it'll give you all of them, things like getDate, sUser, sName. They're all the built-in functions. When you're using Management Studio, if you've got the color coding on, it's that little bright purpley color. Those are all the built-in functions. Try convert is a new feature. In the past, if you use convert to convert from, say, a date to a string, we do that, we can do those conversions, but if an error occurred, your code would break. Now with the try convert, it's sort of like an embedded try catch block, and what it does is when you try to convert it, if the value comes back as null, it means it did not successfully convert the data value. So it's a better way to do your conversions and then test to see if the value is null, and that way you know whether or not the value was successfully converted, but it doesn't throw an error that will stop your batch, and that's the key. Sure. Yeah. So the question was, could you then coalesce the result saying that if it comes back as null, put in a default value? Absolutely. Yep. Parse is now, so I think, are any of you .NET people? A few. I think you can see we're starting to try to conform our extensions to the Transact SQL language to provide a lot of the functionality that you have in the .NET world. So parse basically says, this is a monetary value and I want to parse it in a certain locale. So French, and it would come back in euros. Or Australian, yes. No. I don't know. So here's a thing that you should know. How many of you have been to connect.microsoft.com? Okay, that's where to go. Most people don't realize it, but that goes directly into the triage database for the development team. So if you put an item in there saying, why can't we have regex without doing the SQL CLR, and then get people to vote on it, it actually gets prioritized for the point releases of the next major versions. So that's connect.microsoft.com. It's also where you can go to get beta bits. So if you feel like playing with the next version of SQL Server and you're logged in on connect.microsoft.com, you can go get the early bits for SQL 2016, for example. So good question. But now, right now, the overhead of doing the regex pattern and the match in the SQL CLR function. Yes, you have to do it. You have to register the assembly and all that. But they're not going to get much better performance by... And all they're going to do is shell out and do that anyway. So the question, in case you... Will regular expressions be supported in Transact SQL? Today, if you wanted to do a pattern match to see if a phone number was in the correct format, you can create a SQL CLR object in C sharp and use the regex function to say, does this pattern match or not? And that's the only way to do it today. But, you know, you can do essentially a pattern match for a phone number that I've seen take 12 to 1400 lines of Transact SQL code is two lines in C sharp code, and it performs a whole lot better. The parse is using the culture. Format is the other way. If I want to format currency or dates for a specific locale or culture, we can do that now by passing in the culture info. And then the immediate if is kind of a shorthand. In the past, there's an element called a case statement. So if this, then this, if this, then this. The immediate if is kind of a shorthand notation for a two-item case statement. We say, whatever we're trying to do here, if it's true, we want this value. If it's false, we want that value. So it's kind of a shorthand notation rather than writing the case statement out. Pardon? So what it does is this is, wrong button. This is an expression. It evaluates the expression. So there's not both sides, no. Oh no, so this syntax here is a little misleading. What this says is if, let's say our thing was, if price was less than 50, then we want to put the text cheap. And if it's greater than 50, we want expensive. You have if price greater than less than 50, you would have the text string cheap or expensive. So it's just like a search case statement. So it evaluates the Boolean, and if it's true, it gives you the output of the true column, otherwise the false column. Yes? It's just a shorthand notation. And a lot of programmers are familiar with the immediate if from Excel, Access, VB, and so on. Yes? Anything that can be resolved to a Boolean. So, yes. If you want to do the true searched, you're probably better to do the searched case statement. How we doing? Okay, we're doing all right. We provided windowing and ranking functions in SQL Server. You will see some of these. So, just make sure you know the difference between them. We'll go through the difference. Rank says, I want to use over a group of data, I want to rank the results. So let's say we have salespeople, and we want to window over the sales amount, the sum of the sales amount, and then I want to list the salesperson in the rank who had the most sales. Okay, that's kind of straightforward. The key is for rank, if I have two salespersons with the exact same sales value, they'll both be ranked one if they're the first, the top one. The next output will be three. Or if there were three that were tied, the next output would be four. You have, so rank equals gaps, okay? Dense rank will promote the next highest rank to the next value. So if I have three salespeople with the same exact sales, they will all have rank one. The next one would have rank two. So dense rank is what it sounds like. It's crunched together, there are no gaps. Rank can have gaps in cases of ties. Questions? I mean, that's really it in a nutshell. N-tile allows you to arbitrarily divide your data into clumps, for lack of a better word. Let's say we wanted to look at quarterly sales. We can say N-tile and give it the number 4, and it will try to evenly distribute the values in 4 buckets. So, salesperson is probably the normal example we use for this. But we say, I want to, over the sales date, I want to do N-tile 4. It will then break all the sales into quarters, and then you can, you know, group by the salesperson at that point. Row number is just a convenient way to add an artificial output. It's something that another large RDBMS vendor does by default. We actually have to say row number. They have an item called row ID. But it allows you to say, for this result set, just give me, you know, if there are 12 rows, I have the numbers 1 through 12 prepended to the result set, so that you can then have a way of ordering that data when you get it back. And the good thing is, we pull them along, they pull us along, we pull them along, so within a version or so, everybody has everything the other guy has. It just depends whether we charge extra for it or whether you get it free out of the box. Yes? No. No, you just need to know the characteristics of each of the windowing functions. Yes. That's a great point. These are expensive. This, the over and partition by, the windowing functions are expensive in terms of performance. I highly recommend, if you get your Safari books online, free 30 days, get Itzik Ben Gan's T-SQL Windows function, or high performance Windows functions with TransactSQL 2012, something like that. But it's a book that's specifically on how to either use these functions or how to implement them in TransactSQL and avoid the extra costs, because there are additional overhead for using these functions. A lot of grouping and sorting that has to occur. It's Itzik Ben Gan. It's an MS Press book, and the title is something like High Performance Window Functions or something like that. I don't remember the exact title, I apologize. But if you look up Itzik Ben Gan and MS Press, it'll pop. He also did the Inside T-SQL Querying books in the Inside SQL Server series. All right. There are 4 basic types of joins that you need to understand, and you need to understand the implications of using each of those types of joins. The inner join, which is the default, so if you're a lazy typer, you just say join, or you say inner join, if you want to be explicit, takes 2 tables, joins them on a specific set of columns, and only returns the rows where the columns match. So if I'm joining customers to orders, I would say select blah, blah, blah from customers and orders, join customers, join orders on customer.customerID equals order.orderID. And it's a match. So you only get the rows returned where the join conditions in the on clause match. Pretty straightforward. That's the, probably the 80% rule. We have a concept of an outer join. And an outer join has, for description purposes, a left-hand table and a right-hand table. So if I have customers, left outer join orders, I will now get a result set that lists all of the rows in the customer table, whether or not they have an order placed, and I will also get the rows where they do have orders placed. So this is where you have an optional relationship modeling. So they may or may not have placed an order, but you don't want them to disappear from the result set. So you say left outer join, customers left outer join orders. So all the customers will be listed whether or not they have orders. The key is when there is no match, we null extend the result from the secondary table. And what that means is if the order table had six columns and a customer had not placed any orders, in the result set there would be six null values that indicated that there was no row found in that matching. Right outer join, just flip it on its head. It just says the second table listed, you want all of those values and you want the ones that match and null extend the ones that don't from the left table. So almost always you can rewrite a left and right outer join just by flipping them around. So that's the key to know about an outer join. Full is exactly what it sounds like. And if I see that in your code, now full outer join is a Cartesian product. So in a simple case, if I have five rows in table A, five rows in table B, and I do a full join between those tables, I will get 25 rows. Doesn't seem like much for those. I have 10 million rows in table A, 10 million rows in table B, and I do a full join, you get, what, a billion rows. So I think that's 100 million rows. So be careful with that. There's almost never a reason to do a full join, almost. In some cases, you do, but generally you would restrict that to smaller tables. A cross join is where you're joining a physical table to the output of a table valued function. Now, we haven't talked about functions yet, but you can write a transact SQL function that returns a result set. And the only way to join to that result set is to use the cross operator, cross join operator. The other thing about the full, you may not explicitly say full, but if you do a join to tables and you don't give it an on clause, or in the older syntax where you just list the tables separated by commas and don't do a where clause, that becomes a full outer join. So just be careful. Not important for the exam, but go ahead. I'm sorry, you're right. I'm thinking cross apply and cross. No, you're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, late night last night. Correct. So a full join gives you the full join from all. And then a full join is a left outer join and a right outer join together. So any row that's in the left-hand table is there. If it doesn't have a matching row in the right-hand table, it's null. But if there's one in the right-hand table and not in the left-hand table, the left-hand table rows are null. Thank you. Appreciate that. The cross join is the Cartesian product. We also have a cross-apply operator that allows you to join a table-valued function, which will be on the next slide, I think. So I was getting ahead of myself. But thank you very much. So anybody confused over that? We can go back. Okay. The full is conceptually what we do in the merge statement, which we'll get to in about four or five slides. Oh, look, apply operators. So the cross-apply is exactly what we said. We take a table-valued function and we join to it. It's kind of the same as an inner join between the results of the table-valued function and another physical table. The outer join is similar to outer join, but you're taking the results of a table-valued function and using it as an outer join to your persisted table. Again, you just need to know what the characteristics of each of these are. The outer apply makes it really easy to remember. It has outer in its name. The cross apply, just it's not the outer, so it's the inner. Okay. Common table expressions. A common table expression is essentially a temporary named result set that you can shape the output. It always starts with the keyword with, but with is used a lot in Transact SQL for specifying options. So one thing to note, your previous statement either has to have a semicolon ending it, or you'll find a lot of times people will always put a semicolon in front of the with statement. It's not a typo. It's designed to indicate it's absolutely the beginning of a batch, and so that you won't get a syntax error on the with statement. And the way it works is you give this a temporary name, so you say with customers with orders, and you describe the shape. What columns are you going to have in this temporary named result set? And then you have the select statement that generates that information. Here you can see we've included one of the newer keywords. For those of you that are Transact SQL fans, you know set-based theory and tuple calculus is what drives the relational engine. Intersect is a way to look for the common items. So here we're saying we want to get the customer ID from the customers that have items in the sales order header. It's another way to do it without doing a join. That result set can then be used down here. So we're doing select information from here, and we're actually joining that temporary named result set just as if it was a regular table. There's two different flavors of common table expressions. There's this type where it's more of a convenience or a documentation. It's much more obvious what you're doing rather than having a bunch of embedded sub-selects. The other is you can do recursive programming with a common table expression. Of course, to understand recursive programming, you have to first understand recursive programming. Oh, come on, you guys are geeks. That's a funny geek joke. So essentially what you do is up here for a recursive is you have an anchor query, and it will execute until a certain condition is null, and it does that automatically. And then you have the outer query that consumes it. Where you would use that a lot is like an org chart. So if you had a hierarchical type listing of departments and people and all that kind of stuff, you would use a CTE. Just be aware, anytime you're doing recursive programming, it's expensive in terms of stack and memory usage. So if there's another way to do it, i.e. the hierarchy ID, you may want to consider that rather than doing recursive programming. Null does not equal null. Important to know. If you're checking to see if a column is null, use the is null or is not null keywords. Because null, if you say is this column equal, using the equal sign or the not equal sign, to null, it will never be true. And that's part of the ANSI standard. A case statement allows you to do things just like a case statement would in a procedural language. When this condition exists, do this. If it's this, do this. Generally, it's done for translation, you know, based on some value that you're querying. Then you substitute an output for that column as cheap, medium, expensive, you know, those kinds of things based on the price of an item, for example. Is null is a function, an analytic function, that allows you to say, if the expression is null, go ahead and substitute a value for it. Okay? So the opposite is null if, which is kind of the inverse. If some condition exists, output a null. So this one you probably see, and the idea is this and kind of work hand in hand. Is null is a single value. It says if order date is null, return January 1st, 2001, right? So you don't want to return null, say, to a reporting. You always want to have some value. You use the is null. Coalesce is kind of is null on steroids. You give it a list of items, and whichever first one that it finds that is not null, that's what it returns. Okay. We got to keep moving. If you were an Access, MS Access fan, you know, they had Pivot for years. Allows you to take columns and rows and turn them 90 degrees where rows become columns. So where you want to pivot the data for sales data over a period of time, the pivot is now available. Essentially here we're using a common table expression, and then we're going to pivot that common table expression based on the years in the sales data. And it's the syntax is just pivot. What do you want to pivot on? Which column? What operation do you want to do? And then you give it this list of in values to say how you want to break that pivot up. You may or may not see. So when we do these exam objectives, there's, you know, so many items. Each, you can get multiple forms of an exam, and the test questions fall into percentages, and you may or may not, because of the particular form you get, you may or may not get a pivot. Some of the other items that are not more important, but are weighted heavier, more heavily, then you'll probably get one of those regardless of which form of the exam you get. Roll up in cube. Oh, yes. I certainly can.
Is there a way in the statement?
There's no way to do that easily and programmatically, no. Yeah, I know. Yes? What you'll probably get is you are a developer for Contoso, and they would like to produce a report of sales, you know, by year. And basically, it's going to telegraph the fact that you want to use Pivot, and it'll probably be a multiple choice type question. So just recognizing the fact that you want to take row data, turn them into columns, that bing, 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 Pivot. That's about what you're going to see. You're not going to have to look through the syntax and decide what it does or anything like that. All right. Roll up in cube. I've yet to see anybody use this live. Essentially what it does is it looks through data. You're summing up the total sold. When you do group by roll up, you can say, I want to roll it up once and give me the total sales by region, then I want it by country, and then I want it by category. So it's a single pass through and does multiple aggregation based on different criteria rather than having three select statements that go through the data three times. It's a little more efficient. In this case, only the items that are there will have values. When you're doing cube, it'll also give you subtotal and supertotal and grand total type items. And there'll be null values for the country and region, and that'll indicate that that's a subtotal or a supertotal for those items. Again, this one's kind of like Pivot. It's on the learning objectives. Yes? Yes. As a matter of fact, and no, I did not pay him. So we're going to use grouping sets, and grouping sets is kind of what people will use more often than the cube and roll-up. Grouping sets allows you to do the same kind of aggregations for different sets of data. This is much more efficient because we do a single pass through the data and do all the aggregations at once rather than going through once for a region, country, category, region, category. So you get that whole one pass through and all your aggregations are done. Things to know, the grouping ID will return a bit masked value of the items that you have in your grouping set. What does that mean, Bob? Well, it's weird. But in this case, we have three items. So that would be three bits. So we could have 0 through 7 in binary. Sorry, got to talk binary here. So the grouping ID for this first one would come back with the number 7. The grouping ID for country and category would be 3. No, I'm sorry, that's 2 and 3, so it would be 5. Region and category would be the 1 plus 3, so that would be 4, and category by itself would be 3. So it's just a way to indicate, because you get all these subtotals and all, to indicate which combination of these generated that particular row in the output. So just know that it's a bitmap value that correspond to the values in the grouping sets. Yes? Yes. Yes. Yeah, this was introduced in 2012. Absolutely. Cool. Let's see what slide number I'm on, see how we're doing. Oh boy. All right, we're going to have to pick up the pace. All right. So, for XML, understand the different flavors of the for XML. For XML is a clause on a select statement that will automatically take your result set and turn it into XML for you. If you say raw, it's just going to dump everything out as elements. If you want to get fancier, you can say the auto will automatically create this. So that's kind of equivalent to the raw. Explicit, if you have to use it, I'm sorry. It's a way of generating what's known as a universal table on the fly, and you have to use this weird syntax with the bangs to decide name is going to be from the product, the first element. I want it to be called name, and I want it to be element-centric. You can also have attribute-centric. So the attribute would then be an attribute of product ID. It's difficult to work with. If you have to use it, I'm sorry. There are other ways, XML path, where you can shape the path of your output of your XML, which gives you a little more information, a little more flexibility. So here for XML path with the product, we get the same kind of output. Here you could also say elements. You can also say with XML schema, and it will emit the XSD prior to the XML. So there's a lot of options. Just read through books online and understand what each of the options do.
I wrote this just on Sunday, and I had 10 questions on XML that I've seen with the XML prior.
Yes, and there was query nodes exists and all that, the XPath, yes. So XML is fairly heavily weighted in this exam. So, yeah. And XPath, just something you have to sit down and look at, and if you're not using it on a day-to-day basis, it's. I always have to go back to the reference or ask somebody else because I'm not an XPath guy. We introduced, again in 2012, this concept of being able to do rolling fetches. So the key word here is offset. We want to offset X number of rows, fetch the next number of rows. And then keep going. So this would be if you wanted to use a paging where you wanted to keep the result sets on the server, you wanted to grab 10. The key is, though, you pass these in as variables, which you keep on the client side. We re-execute the query, and if there's 10 million rows in the table and you're paging through 10 rows at a time, we have to do that same query over and over and over again. So it was an attempt to try to help solve the paging conundrum that everybody experiences. Probably the better design pattern, in my opinion, is to store this in a temp table in tempdb, a global temp table, iterate over that so you don't have to redo the queries multiple times. You can use this on a temp table. So that's one way to alleviate the performance issues. So just understand that the offset says we're going to move this number down into my result set, so we're going to essentially skip that number of rows, and then I'm going to return the number of rows that we asked for. So, again, we're short on time. Basically, what we want to say is, how do we know which field is being used to do the aggregated data? It's the grouping ID. So you have to look at that bitmap to see which of the columns in the grouping set is producing that total or subtotal. That's the important thing to know there. All right. Again, just like with the views, you can encrypt stored procedures. It's an option. Just be aware that it's available. What that does is it prevents the text being saved in sys.sys comments. Also, when you go to modify, you get nothing in the, if you do modify stored procedure, you get nothing except the create procedure, and there's no body. One thing you will see is some questions on the execute as. So let's say I have a stored procedure that I don't want to give access to the underlying tables, but I, as the owner of the table and the stored procedure, have access to them. I can grant execute to a stored procedure, and then in the definition of the stored procedure, I can say execute as self, meaning me, or owner. And so when the user has the permission to execute, because the security context of that execution is me, and I have permission to the underlying tables, the stored procedure can return data to the user without giving the user security privileges to the underlying table. Owner and self are very similar. Owner is the current owner. Self is the person that created the module originally. Caller is if you don't want the security context to operate as the owner or the self, you want it to be executed as the person calling it to ensure that they do have the chain of events or the chain of security principles that allow them to do that. Yes, that is default. Recompile is, without getting into a lot of detail, there are times when you call a stored procedure and it performs great, and you call it another time with different parameters and it may not perform so well. You can add with recompile to your stored procedure, and what that says, every time the stored procedure is called, please recompile it with the set of parameters that are being passed at that time. That's kind of like killing a fly with a hand grenade. There are some other things that we'll talk about where you can do some options that say, for, you know, state, I want you to assume you don't know what that is, or I want you to assume this country is U.S. And so you can change the at the query level the assumptions that are made by the query optimizer on the parameters. So just know that if you're having problems with parameter sniffing where you run it once, it runs great, you run it again with a different set of parameters and it runs poorly, with recompile is an option on the stored procedure. All right, the update statement. There's really not, I mean, the regular font type is the syntax for an update statement. There's not a lot to say about it. You update a table, you set a column equal to a value. Where some of the additional information is, when you do this, the same pseudo tables are available. So let's say you wanted to capture this into a temporary table to do auditing. You could then say output deleted, blah, 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 into, and give it a temporary table. So you can capture that for auditing. You also have the dollar sign action that's available in the output clause, which will tell you whether it was an insert, update, or delete. Again, knowing the basic update statement and understanding that you can capture the output of the results, so the before and after image of the update through the pseudo tables, just like you would in a trigger. Merge statement is also commonly referred to as an upsert. Essentially, what we're saying is, if the data exists, I want to update it. If it doesn't exist, I want to insert it. And if I've got it, if I don't have it and it's there, I want to delete it. Normally, you use this in ETL, data warehouse processing, where you're loading a bunch of data over time. Normally written as three separate statements. Three passes, three compilations, it becomes expensive. The merge statement essentially does a full outer join. It takes the source table and the target table and does a full outer join. So if there's a value in the source table, then and there's none in the destination table or target, that's an insert. If there's an item in the target table and not in the source, that's a delete. And if there's one in the again, there's other flavors on it, but whether they're matched and matched with additional conditions. But it gives you a way to do the insert, update, delete all in a single statement. Yes. Yeah, so it's the different clauses here. You do the you have a target. So you have a small table, let's say, of data that came in the last hour. The target is your big fact table. You say on, and you do the join based on the join condition. So this is how I uniquely identify the row in that table. Then you can add one or more of these. You can add matched or not matched. So if it's matched, you do the update. If it's not matched, then it becomes an insert. And you write the code that occurs when you do the matched and not matched. And I think I have a sample here. Yeah. So here, when they're matched, then update. If they're not matched, insert. So it's your code that you write to do this work. But rather than having to do multiple instances, we're done. We're done, but I'm willing to stay. Lunch is for a couple hours, so if you guys want to stay, there are a fair number of slides. I'll be happy to continue to go through. So otherwise, thank you for attending. There's a slide at the end with a QR tag, which you can't see, but please feel free to go ahead and submit an evaluation. It's how I get to come back year after year. Also, this $ action, this is where you can do the auditing on your merge syntax to keep your data lineage if you're doing ETL processing. So you need to create a stored procedure, blah, blah, blah. We already talked about this. Execute as self allows that stored procedure to execute in the context of the person that created the stored procedure. Again, I'm rushing to get you guys to lunch. So when you're talking about joins, you don't specifically, in most cases, specify the join type. These are the three types of joins that you'll see in a query execution plan. A nested loop uses a source table and a probe table. It generally puts the larger table on top if everything has gone well, iterates through each item in the lower table, looking for a matching value in the upper table. When it finds it, it emits that row. So the thing to know is it's good for smaller joins that are not sorted. It's a non-blocking, non-memory grant requiring operator, so that's important to know. Merge joins are two data sets that are really large, but they're both sorted in the same order. So we can just start with the source table, look for a match in the destination table or the probe table, and if there's a match, we output the row until that changes and no longer matches. Then we go to the next one. Is there a match? No, because I've already found a value that's higher. We skip that one. And it just goes in order. It's order preserving, it's non-blocking, and it has a minimal memory grant if it has to spill the disk. Hash join, it's basically what we fall back to if we can't figure anything else out. We build, we have the source table and the probe table. We build a hash table of all the key values. Then row by row, we have to hash the value in the outer table and compare it to see if it's in the hash table. It requires memory grant, and it is blocking because it has to see all the input data before it can output the data. Yes. Yeah, so yeah, if you can force a previous step in the execution plan to be sorted such that it's in the same order as whatever you're joining to, yes, then we will choose the merge at that point. Yes. Yep. In most cases. Sometimes the optimizer is cranky. When we're talking about transactions are a unit of work. It's what causes have you ever heard the term ACID, A-C-I-D? Atomic, consistent, isolated, and durable. Transactions are what provide the atomic nature of a transaction. If I have a batch of SQL code that's running, either all of that code runs successfully or none of it. So we either commit all of those changes or we roll back all of those changes. So just understand there's a begin transaction, commit transaction, and a rollback. You may or may not see the save transaction and that allows you in nested transactions to give a name so that you can roll back. Because if you don't provide a save point and you have nested transactions, if you roll back an inner transaction, it rolls back the entire transaction. If you have a save point, you can save. Let's say you have three levels of nesting, and the two outer are critical, but the inner one you don't really care about. You can have a save point so that if that fails, you roll that back, but the rest of your transactions commit. All right, isolation levels. So to find an ANSI, this is, and this could be a whole hour topic. So just understand the difference between read uncommitted, what that allows. There are a couple terms you need to know. Phantom reads, which means if I go back and reread the data, I may not read the data that, the first time I read it, a phantom read, I can read data that wasn't committed yet by another transaction. If I go back and reread it, it may not be there anymore. Dirty reads means I'm reading data that's being modified by another transaction, but it hasn't been committed yet. So read committed, the locks are during the execution, that is the default. So read committed is the default isolation level. Read committed is the default isolation level. If you don't change it, read committed, you're gonna see some questions. And in fact, some of our other technologies like read committed snapshot isolation takes advantage of the fact that read committed is the default isolation level. Repeatable read is less concurrency because we hold locks longer. Serializable not only locks the data elements, but the spaces between the data elements. So if I'm doing a between statement, I'm going to do an update in serializable mode, and I say between January 1st and January 30th, and there was no data for January 15th, I would also lock the space where that data doesn't exist. So I can't insert a value for January 15th if that range is locked. So serializable, as you go down the stack, the consistency is better, concurrency is worse. So it's just kind of the way to look at it. And if you look at these in the SysTypes table, they're actually numbered. That's 1, 2, 3, and 4 are the transaction types. There is a 0 by the ANSI standard known as chaos. All bets are off. It's actually in the standard. Most people don't implement it. Snapshot isolation allows us to get better concurrency by saying I have a table. That table is used a lot for both reading and writing. And I can say when I start this, I would like to use snapshot isolation level. And we will create a copy of the data that's consistent as the point of at the start of that transaction and put it in tempdb. So if I'm updating rows and all that data will go to tempdb. Readers that come in and ask for it will say, oh, that's locked, okay. Go over to tempdb and get a transactionally consistent view of that data as it was at the beginning of the transaction. That is on a case-by-case basis. Let's say in a system of 1,000 tables, you only have 2 tables that are having the reader-writer blocks. You would use the snapshot isolation. It requires more coding, but there's no need to incur all these versions for all the other tables in your system. If all of your system, or the majority of your tables in your system, are experiencing the reader-writer blocks, then you can turn on the read-committed snapshot. At that point, any transaction that is in the read-committed snapshot, which we know is the default isolation level, will automatically create version stores. So it removes the reader-writer blocks. This was really introduced to allow Oracle to move to SQL Server because the locking mechanisms are so different. This emulates the versioning that Oracle uses to allow this type of concurrency. Try-catch was introduced. For those of you that are programmers, it now gives you the ability to capture errors, not just have the batch fail and raise a raise error, or raise roar, if you talk to Tobias. It's just very similar to procedural languages. You try to do some work. If it works, you commit the transaction. Otherwise, you roll it back and you can get some error information to send back to the client. So very similar to try-catch blocks. There is no finally yet. Yes? No, 2012. Cursors, don't use them. No, there's some kinds when it's like end-of-month processing for an accounting system where you have to have, there are places for them. And then actually in a lot of our system stored procedures, we do use them. So, but they're very expensive in terms of resources. But the key steps that you need to know, first you declare it, you open it, and when you declare it, you're saying certain columns and so on. You fetch the first set of data. Now you create a loop, and while the fetch status is not equal to zero, you just keep iterating through. When you're done with the data, you close it and make sure you deallocate it. Because if you forget this step, all of the resources are held in use until that connection is dropped. So, this is on every version of SQL Server. Yeah, this has been here since Sybase, yeah. Hints are not hints. They're directives. Why we call them hints, I'm not sure. This is the one I was talking about earlier. If you're having parameter sniffing, you can say, I want to optimize this query to always think that most of the queries are going to be from Seattle, but I don't know what the postal code is within Seattle. And the optimizer will choose at compile and runtime, it will choose to recompile the portions that have a postal code so that it's using the distribution, the statistics, or the data distribution for the value that's being sent in at runtime. In this case, tab lock means I know that I'm going to be the only person working. I want to lock the table immediately. I don't want to do a bunch of row locks and then escalation to table locks. I'm doing some kind of expensive process here where we're raising all of our prices, and so I'm just going to take a table lock. Again, go in using the hints, knowing what you're doing, because if you upgrade to the next version of SQL Server and your problem is solved, your hints are still going to override the new version of the query optimizer. All right, we got through all the meat. If anybody wants to stay for this, blah, 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 set a date, blah, 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 register, yep. Here's some more resources, and then win an Xbox One, and there's the evaluation. There is a hands-on lab. What's new in SQL 2012 for T-SQL, and then the other exam, of course, we'll be covering after lunch today. Thank you for hanging out. I realize it went long. Hopefully you got something out of it. Y'all have a great day.